but as of next week, I'll be working on Sundays for a while. So this is going to be the last in this series for a period of time, not sure how long. And when I looked on Friday, when I got word that I was going to be working on Sundays, and thought about how to wrap up what we've been doing for the last 6 or 7 or 8 months or however long it's been, how to wrap that up in a 45-minute message, I decided it couldn't be done, so we're not going to do that. I will give a brief summary of what we've done, but the most important thing to understand in what we've been doing here is we are studying the Bible. We started out in the Garden of Eden with God's creation. And when we looked at the creation story at the very beginning of the study, what we discovered was that God created a very good world. He created it the way He intended it to be. Everything that He created, He looked back at the end of the day and saw what He had done and said, "It is good." And at the end, on the end of the sixth day, when He had created man and put him in authority over all of His creation, He looked back at that and said, "It is very good." So we were given a picture in the Garden of Eden of what God intended for the relationship between man and Himself and His creation, what it should be, what it really was intended to be by God's purposes. And we've been using Andy Woods' book as a guide for us to study what this coming kingdom that we anticipate, that we look forward to, is really like and where it is. The kingdom that we're talking about in this book is the millennial kingdom. What is going to happen following the tribulation period? I've got this picture or timeline of prophecy that we've looked at several times. You know, creation is way to the left on this chart. And then the Old Testament period came along, and we see that in Scripture, as we studied and went through everything, that all of history since the fall of man in Genesis chapter 3, all of history, all of the Bible, everything in the Bible is kind of centered around God's plan for restoration of the fellowship that He has with man, and how that's going to come about, the things that He's set in place in order to bring it about, the restoration of the authority of God over this earth, and all of that is encompassed in what the Bible teaches about the coming kingdom. Now, we've talked about the church age, we've talked about the tribulation, and the second advent of Christ when He returns to this earth to establish His authority and His kingdomship, His rule over this earth from David's throne in Jerusalem. And again, we looked at it very literally, because I think it's intended to be taken literally. So in that look, we saw what characteristics there were going to be in that thousand-year period that we call the millennial kingdom. And all this is done in preparation for something else that we've been talking about recently. At the end of that thousand-year kingdom, Satan is released from the abyss, and he goes around the world and gathers his followers that are still left in the world all together for one last final battle. And in that final battle that we have studied, evil is defeated forever. And then we enter the eternal state. And we've been talking about the eternal state these last several weeks. And what we've talked about in the eternal state, and that's the period of time that begins with the end of the thousand-year kingdom, with the end of the old earth and the old heavens and the creation of the new heavens and the new earth. This eternal state where we will live forever and ever in fellowship, in close fellowship with God, has certain characteristics that we've talked about. We know that it happens after the thousand-year kingdom after the theocratic administration, after that is completely reestablished at the end of the thousand-year millennium, that and then the new heaven and new earth are created. And I gave you several reasons why I think and I believe that it's a new creation and not just a renovation of this old earth, but a new creation. That all of this is brand new. The new heaven and new earth, the way it's described, the events leading up to it, and all of that. It's a new order and different. And we've talked about some of the characteristics between the millennial kingdom and the eternal state, how they're different. And we're going to talk about a little bit more about that tonight, because I really want to focus on this eternal state here in this last message that I'm going to give you for a while. So in the eternal state, we know that Jesus and God rule together from the throne, that the two thrones that are described in different passages throughout the Bible are merged into one in this eternal state, where the throne of God and the Lamb are combined into one. So Christ is ruling with God as part of that unity of the Trinity forever and ever. So, you know, the promises that God made to David that his line would rule forever and ever, those are fulfilled in the eternal state with Christ ruling with God. And, you know, so we have gotten to the point now where we're talking about the eternal state and what it's like. And this is the message for today, the eternal state's description. And I'm going to end here in this series for a while. You know, part of the problem is that there's so much material that there's no way to really go through it. So this is going to be probably just an introduction to this, because there's, you know, we could talk about God's house, the New Jerusalem, the description of the New Jerusalem in the various places. You know, that could be 3 or 4 weeks on its own, and we may do that later. So bear with me here. The eternal state's description has several characteristics. It's different than the millennial kingdom. And let's talk about that now. It's different than the millennial kingdom. If you look at Revelation 20, Revelation 20 describes the millennial kingdom. And Revelation chapters 21 and 22 describe the characteristics of the eternal state. And if you look at these two passages and go through them, you see several things. You know, first, in the millennial kingdom, we talked that the curse, the effects of the curse and sin, is restrained in the millennial kingdom. It's not eliminated completely because people still die. We see that clearly. And there will be lost people in the millennial kingdom, descendants of those who entered the kingdom as Christians, as believers in God, in Christ. But their descendants then still have that sin nature in their mortal bodies and sin. But in the eternal state, in chapters 21 and 22, sin will be completely removed. It doesn't exist. And I mentioned the curse restrained. And in the eternal state, the curse is completely removed in this new heaven and new earth that God creates. And whether you believe it's a renovation or an entirely new creation, the point is that it's completely different. It is completely, the effects of the curse on creation is gone completely. In the millennial kingdom, as I mentioned, there's death. In the eternal state, there will be no death. There's no death, no pain, no sorrow. The millennial kingdom will be made up and the populated by both mortals and resurrected people, those with resurrection bodies. And that's a difficult concept for some to grasp, perhaps. But the biblical accounts give us a description of this as well, in that when Christ arose from the grave, he was in his resurrected body. He, you know, he had that completely renovated, resurrected body, yet he dwelt with mortals. You know, everyone that he appeared to, all the disciples and the crowds that he appeared to in the 40 days that he was here after he rose, he was coexisting with them. He sat down with them. They touched him physically. Thomas touched his hands to see where the nails had pierced. And he ate with them. You know, so there's some clues in this as to what's going to happen in our resurrected bodies as well. So in the millennium, there will be people whose destinies have not been decided. Again, I said that there were believers. When the millennial kingdom starts, it's only believers. But the descendants of the mortals that survived the tribulation and entered the millennial kingdom, those descendants, their fates are undecided until they accept the forgiveness that Jesus provides through the forgiveness of sins and a sacrifice on the cross. But in the eternal state, it will be only those who have been believers and now have been resurrected, and they're after the great white throne judgment. Both the lost and the believers' destinies are established and fixed forever and ever. The millennial kingdom has, when we went through it, we know that things happen physically to the earth. Things change. The earth becomes more productive with the lifting of the curse, and you know the Mount of Olives is split, and the New Jerusalem comes, and there's a temple in the millennial kingdom. But the eternal state we'll see in a little bit is different than that. The millennial kingdom only lasts for 1,000 years, so it's temporary. We've talked about it and illustrated it this way, that the millennial kingdom is the front porch to eternity. We go through this, and there's a process that occurs there for the restoration of the authority of God over the earth, physically over this earth. But the eternal state is forever. There is no end. Difficult grasp for us mortals to I'm a engineer, so mathematics was a big part of my education. And when we think about eternity or an infinite line or something, you know, if I start from this point and go forever that way, that line is no longer than or shorter than if I started at this point and went both ways. That's, you know, that aspect of eternity or infinity is difficult for us to understand sometimes in concept. And maybe that's not a very good illustration, but you know, it's difficult to get our hands around. And the millennial kingdom is transitional. It's a period of time where, again, the mortal remaining survivors of the tribulation and their descendants are transitioning from, and even we as resurrected people are transitioning from our lives as mortals to the eternal state and in our immortality in that period. So the millennium and the eternal state also have several key characteristics that are specifically mentioned that are similar, that there are things in the millennial kingdom and the eternal state that are the same. First of all, there's time in both elements. You know, people say, will we even notice the passage of time in the eternal state? And if you look at Revelation chapter 22, verse 5, you know, it talks about that. 22, verse 5 says, "And there will no longer be any night, and they will not have need of the light of a lamp or light of the sun. For the Lord God will illumine them, and they will reign forever and ever." You know, we won't have night and day like we have now, so we won't mark the passage of days with the rising and setting of the sun, because it's all light because of God's presence with us. You know, the sun and the moon are different in the eternal state. The passage says And there's a lot of discussion over this as to whether there will be or won't be a sun and a moon. Clearly, the passage says there's no need for a sun and moon. So you could interpret that to say, well, it might be there, but, you know, that's one of those questions that we're going to answer a thousand and however many years from now. But, you know, so the passage of time will be different, but, you know, when it talks about forever and ever in this verse, it does kind of imply that there will be a sense of time in the passage of ages. The luminaries, you know, these passages talk about, again, the presence of God and how his very presence illumines the world. You know, there will be death in the millennial state. There will not be death in the eternal state. And satanic activity in the eternal state. We've read chapter 20, verse 7 many times about how Satan is cast into the abyss during the eternal state, but there's still evil in the world. There is still some reduced effects of the curse on the world, so that's still there, so that will survive. And there will be a rebellion at the end of the millennial kingdom, but there will be no rebellion in the eternal state because we will be living in Shangri-La or whatever you want to call it, will be there. The Garden of Eden is our guide to, you know, the perfection of the world that we'll be living in. There won't be any rebellion in the eternal state because the effects of sin are gone. So the eternal state is different than the millennial kingdom. But what's the significance of that? You know, what can we look at now and say, well, you know, it really doesn't matter what's happening out there. It really, you know, does it really matter in how I should live today? Well, yes, it does. I think that as Christians, there are some things that we need to understand that the eternal state really clears up for us in our theological beliefs and things. And first of all, the fact that the eternal state will exist and is coming and exists in the form that it does tells us very clearly that evil is finite. You know, the world that we live in, and it doesn't take a lot of looking to realize that there's a lot of evil in this world. But it's dated. It's got an end. And the dreams and aspirations that are part of us as human beings and that desire for good that is so suppressed by evil, you know, that it should be encouraging to us as Christians for us to be able to look at the eternal state and see that there is no evil there, that evil's days are numbered. You know, again, I joke that it's a thousand and however many years. Evil will be no more, and that should encourage us. You know, and another aspect is that, you know, the eternal state is not a dispensation. And I'm saying that, and I'm a little nervous because somebody in this room has studied the dispensations a lot more than I have. But let me put it this way, and I'll see if I get a nod or a... But, you know, what are the dispensations? The dispensations are, very simply put, how God is dealing with man during a particular period of time to bring him to him. How is God dealing with man in order to draw him to himself, to draw mankind to himself? That's how the dispensations work. The Old Testament gave us the law, and that made man realize that he needed a God and showed the shortcomings that he had. The dispensation that we're in now, this the church age or the age of the Holy Spirit, you know, is again how God is working in the world through the circumstances of the world to draw mankind to Him. But in the eternal state, we are in perfect fellowship with God. There is no more need for God to draw man to Him because He's there present with him eternally and literally. So it's not a dispensation in that sense. And we could have some arguments later. I got a smile, so I must have done okay. Or maybe it's a grimace, I don't know. And the other thing, the other significance of the eternal state is that it is a period that is greater than the millennium. We look forward to the millennium in so many ways because we know that that's the time when all of history has been working towards getting us into that millennium, the time of the tribulation and the passage from the tribulation into the millennium. That's something that we as Christians get real excited about and are interested in. But the thing we need to understand is that that's just the front porch. The house is still to be entered. And it is much greater than the millennial kingdom. And I didn't change my slides, so you guys, you know, so this is all the, you know, these things make up the importance of the existence of a millennial kingdom. And there are, you know, some that say that Eden was kind of a probationary test for mankind to see, you know, is he ready? I mean, we've created mankind, you know, so let's put him in this environment and see how he does. Well, you know, we showed our shortcomings. You know, God gave us a free will. He only gave us one rule: don't eat of the fruit of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. He only gave us one rule. You know, that wasn't a very thick Bible, not like we have today. You know, and we couldn't even do that. So we need God. We need that fellowship with God in order to overcome the shortcomings that we have, and we'll have that in the, you know, so that nature, that sin nature will be taken away and will be absent from us in this time. So the, you know, as we look at Eden as a probationary environment, the transition from what Eden had in the eternal state, you know, I'm not going to go through all of these because there's just not that much time left in the day. You know, but these things show the differences between Eden and the eternal state. You know, there's no division of night and day. There's no darkness. You know, darkness has so many meanings and such a significance. You know, the Garden of Eden was a garden where the eternal state is identified by God's city. And so there's a difference. You know, there's a river flowing out of Eden. But in the eternal state, the river, which symbolizes, you know, the life, doesn't flow out from the garden. It flows out from the throne of God. You know, the tree of life is in the middle of the garden, in the Garden of Eden. But in the coming eternal state, the tree of life is throughout the city. It's not just a single tree. You know, there's all precious stones and everything. And one of the things, you know, there's a song, I Walk Through the Garden Alone. And God is there with you. You know, it's a wonderful song, and it always makes me think of this. But in the Garden of Eden, you know, God walked through the garden with Adam. You know, where are you, Adam? And Adam would respond, and until he tried to hide from God as God was walking through the garden because he had sinned. But in the eternal state, God will be among us. You know, there are characteristics of God, and one of those is that he's clothed and in what's the word I'm looking for? A great light, to where we can't even look upon him because of the glory that shines from him in such brilliant illuminance that we can't even look upon him. And you remember the story of Moses when he had been in God's presence on top of the mountain. When he came down, his face was still radiating that reflected glory from God for just that brief period of time. But in the eternal state, we'll be able to see him. We'll be able to walk beside him. He'll know our names. I'm getting into some weak theological areas there, but so that it, you know, it's theologically significant, and where it occurs in history, all of these periods that we've gone through, the Old Testament times, the Church Age, the pre-Diluvian times, and you know every period of history in our world has looked forward to a time of great fellowship and unity with God. You know, so the Old Testaments even describe the kingdom and the eternal state. But let's go back and review a little bit what they had to say about the kingdom. And we studied each of these in detail. So go back and look at some of the old presentations. You know, the Old Testament kingdom was the coming kingdom, the millennial kingdom, was established by God. It wasn't an afterthought. It, you know, once man fell, God didn't have to come up with Plan B, as it's referred to so many times in some of the detractors from this kind of theology. You know, the eternal kingdom lasts forever. You know, and we talk about the millennial kingdom being that transition from mortal life to the eternal state. You know, it's on this earth. The millennial kingdom is on this earth. The land promises are realized in the millennial kingdom. You know, and these other things that we studied very carefully all describe the kingdom, and we see that language in the Old Testament. So what is life going to be like in the eternal state? What will the eternal state be like? You know, we've seen all these descriptions of the millennial kingdom. So what do we know about the eternal kingdom? And I've read several articles in the last couple of weeks trying to answer that question. And there's not a lot, but there's also not nothing. Use a double negative there and get us all confused. But mostly, when we talk about the eternal state, we know a lot of things that are absent from the eternal state. And if we look at Revelation chapter 20, a lot of these are identified. You know, first of all, it says that there's no Satan in verse 10. There's no sea in Revelation 21:1. And these things are timing on their own, so we'll see how we get through these. There's no death, crying, or pain. Won't that be good? These 62-year-old knees are telling me that that'll be something I look forward to. There's no sun and no moon. Again, whether that means there's no sun or no moon or no need, that's you could write theses over that one. There's no temple in the eternal state. And why is there no temple? What's the purpose of the temple? The purpose of the temple is to where the Shekinah glory of God was. Yeah, now I'm getting ahead of myself. Sorry. So there's no temple because the presence of God is everywhere, not just existing in the inner sanctum of the temple as it was designed. There's no night. The passage of time is noticeable but different in the eternal state. But best of all, and most of all, perhaps, not best of all, because that's the presence of God, but there's no evil and no curse in the eternal state. And won't that be a relief? We won't have to guard ourselves against temptation like we do in this life. Everything will be available to us and given to us. So there's all these things that are going to be absent in the eternal state that are present in this world now. But there's also things identified in this passage in Revelation 21 and 22. that are present in the eternal state. So what will be present? First of all, God's presence will be there. And I'm going to have trouble because it's going to try and time this out. But, we studied, Terry led us through a study of the book of Ezekiel. And in that study, we talked about the time when the Shekinah glory left the temple. And from that time on, the temple couldn't, there was no restriction on God's being in the temple. I mean, he didn't have to stay there. He was free to go wherever he wanted or be wherever he wanted. But his presence was in the temple for a long time, hundreds of years. But just before, when Israel was sinning and falling away from following God, just before the Babylonian captivity, and again, this is in Ezekiel chapter 10, the Shekinah glory left the temple, and God allowed the temple to be captured and destroyed during the Babylonian invasions and conquest. And God's presence kind of left the earth generally at that time. There's been times when it returned. There's a few stories in the Old Testament that talk about God's presence came. But mostly it's been absent, and it will be here again in that eternal state. And related to that is God's glory in Revelation 21:23. The city has no need of the sun or the moon to shine on it, for the glory of God has illumined it, and its lamp is the Lamb, God's glory and the Lamb's glory. God's holiness will be present there. Have you ever just thought about how, some of the Old Testament stories we know talk about, when Moses came into the presence of God, the angel said to him, "Take off your shoes because this is a holy place." To be in the presence of that holiness and to be able to just be there, and that holiness all around us, that's something to look forward to. God's people will be there. If you are a believer, you will be there. God's city will be there. And a lot has been written about God's city and the description that we have of God's city in Revelation 21, starting in verse 2. And its description is so stunning, for lack of another word, that a lot of people just can't take it literally. They have difficulty with that because the dimensions are such that, if I've read that if the dimensions in the Bible that are given for God's city, if that were placed on the United States, one corner would be in Sacramento, California, and another corner would be in New Orleans, Louisiana. And another corner would be in Toronto, Canada. It just is a large, and it's a cube. So how could something like that exist? It's beyond our understanding, but not beyond God's capabilities. And that's something that we need to understand. Again, the existence of the city, the name of the city, the dimensions, the description of the walls, the literal description of the gates and the foundation stones and everything that's described, as well as its influence over all of creation, the character, the glory, the colors. The caricature of heaven a lot of times is us all sitting around on clouds and puffy white clouds and robes and a mist and singing and playing harps. Well, that's not it. The vibrant colors that are described in the description of the city gives lie to that kind of an impression. So when we think of heaven, we should be thinking about vibrant colors, the life that's going to be there, the encouragement that we're going to have with one another, and the presence of God is, we're not blinded by the light. But everything is enhanced because of the light. The colors of the stones and just the description. All of this, it's going to be a wonderful place. And what life is going to be like, I'm going to go over quickly just six characteristics of what life will be like. You know, we will have fellowship one with another. We'll be able to recognize people. We'll have fellowship one with another, but we'll also have fellowship with God and Jesus. You know, we'll have acts of service in this. You know, God, you know, I say this often. You know, God didn't give Adam and Eve work to do after the fall. God gave Adam and Eve work to do before the fall. Work is not part of the curse, folks. As much as it may seem like it sometimes, work is a blessing. And we will enjoy the full fruits of that blessing. The curse made our work ineffective. It didn't, you know, so we will be restored to that period of time when our work is effective and fruitful and enjoyable. We'll have fulfillment. You know, oh, I just don't know what I'm going to do with my life. I just feel empty. I've been working my whole life and I just, everything feels lost. We won't have that sense in that eternal state because everything we do will be fruitful and will be fulfilling. We'll be satisfied with life. You know, the old adage, you know, the more you have, the more you want. We won't have that thirst for more because everything will be at our, you know, I'm not saying this right, but that desire for more will be absent from us. That's a part of the curse. You know, we'll have complete rest. We'll be able to relax and not be tense about things. There will be no anxiety. So it will be a restful time. And knowledge will be universal. The illustration that Dr. Woods provided in his description of this had a picture of, you know, Einstein. Will we know everything? Well, yes, I think we will. You know, we'll be ruling and reigning. We'll be given responsibilities. We'll be given tasks to do. It'll be a time of worship and perfect worship. You know, we worship imperfectly, but in heaven we will be able to worship fully and completely. We'll live in a glorified body. We've talked about that a little bit too. And this next one, it says there's no consequences of sin, which is a little... Because there's no sin, there's no consequence. You know, I mentioned my knees earlier. Yeah, my knees hurt. But my knees hurt because I did bad things with them when I was younger. You know, so the bad things that we do causes us physical issues. And sin has that same effect. So those consequences will be gone. That will... not happen because there's no sin. There's no consequences of sin, and it'll last forever. When in Revelation chapter 20, it says forever and ever. And I've talked many times about that repetition of the forever idea, just meaning emphasizing the forever and ever aspects. And I am about out of time, but I want to get. I'm going to skip through a few things here because I want to talk about this last item. You know, how do we get there? How do we get ourselves to a position where we can look forward to this eternal state? And that is very simple, and God set it up from the very beginning to be very simple. Philippians 3:9 says, and may be found in him, not having a righteousness of my own derived from the law, but that which is through faith in Christ, the righteousness which comes from God on the basis of faith. Folks, in order to be able to be admitted into this eternal state, all we have to do is believe. The price has been paid for the sins that we've committed. Christ gave himself a perfect sacrifice, that perfect lamb that was slain, to atone for the transgressions that we have committed. He himself was found without sin and had done no wrong. but he laid down his life willingly so that I and you could have that eternal fellowship with him and that eternal state. That eternal state is the conclusion of all that God has created. And he desires that for everyone. In the Gospel of John, it said that God desires that no one should be left behind, but that all should have fellowship with him. And that's his desire for us, for you, for me. So, folks, we need to believe. We need to accept that sacrifice was made for me. I know that I've sinned. I know that I've sinned. But I know that my Redeemer lives. So let's go to prayer.